Alabama enacted a measure in April derided by critics as the Don't Say Gay law. It bans discussions of sexual orientation and gender identity in K-5 classrooms and is similar to a Florida law. WBHM's Kyra Miles reports it puts pressure on teachers and families with LGBTQ parents.
Matching with Miss America on a dating app and then marrying her sounds like a movie, but it's reality for Abbott Downs.
Yep, 7-day free trial, match with Miss America. My friends who do online dating all the time were furious with me.
They've been together for 5 years, and now Downs has 2 kids, a 12-year-old stepson from her wife's previous marriage.
And then we have baby Ella, who's 8 months old.
Downs and baby Ella often come to the Birmingham Botanical Gardens to get some fresh air.
Go see some roses? Go see some roses?
But recently, something has been weighing on her family. A new law in Alabama bans discussions about sexuality and gender identity in K-5 classrooms.
As a gay parent raising children, the part that bothers me is it seems to want to exclude conversation about my family in particular in the classroom.
The law's original sponsors said they wanted to protect young girls from predators by requiring students to use the bathroom that matched the gender on their birth certificates. But on the day they voted, a last-minute change also banned discussions about sexuality and gender identity. Downs says she agrees that kids in K-5 classes shouldn't learn anything explicit in education.
Where I think we depart, though, is this notion that somehow talking about my family with two moms is more sexualized and more adult content than talking about another child's family with a mom and a dad. I feel like a heterosexual family shouldn't just be the default.
Gay families in Alabama are really actually not anything new.
Paul Hard is a professor at Auburn University at Montgomery and one of the first people who sued the state for marriage equality. He says it's not until recent years that LGBTQ relationships have started to be openly acknowledged. But this law is a setback.
We're communicating to children that their family, that their existence is something shameful. As long as you can keep people like my husband and I and our kids invisible, we don't exist.
According to the Movement Advancement Project, a nationwide policy mapping think tank, a quarter of LGBTQ adults in Alabama are raising children. Hard says his family has considered moving out of the state, but it's home for them.
There's a lot of good work our legislators can be doing instead of contributing to this bigotry and making it clear that if you're LGBTQ, we don't want you in Alabama.
This isn't the first time Alabama legislation has targeted the LGBTQ community in schools. Until last year, teachers were supposed to follow outdated sex education standards that emphasize that homosexuality is not a, quote, lifestyle acceptable to the general public and is illegal under the laws of the state. Current standards for elementary education majors put emphasis on teaching diverse populations. But standards don't always reflect reality, and it's not clear how this law will impact classrooms. Dawn Fields teaches third graders.
And I play jazz in the mornings when they're doing their morning work.
Fields says she values student-led discussions in her classroom at Huntington Place Elementary in Northport.
I'm just trying to be a safe place for a kid who may not have a safe place because of 100 different circumstances.
She says that topics of gender or sexuality haven't come up in her class. But now if they do, she says it feels like her job is on the line.
Even though it hasn't come up, I would almost feel muzzled or handcuffed.
Another new law in Alabama requires teachers to tell parents if a student says they might be transgender. Field says it goes against her philosophy as an educator to not only teach her students, but create a sense of community for them.
What if I have a kid next year and he wants to share about his moms? I'm gonna let him. They're 8. They're really not sharing for their classmates. They just want to tell me. They want to tell me. Why? Because I'm their teacher. I'm that trusted adult in their safety network. Or that's what I'm supposed to be when I'm allowed to be.
Field says if something happens in her class, she'll follow the proper channels and figure out what to do with administration. But she says her first priority is always going to be the well-being of her students. Kyra Miles, WBHM.
Northeast Alabama is one of the best spots on earth for gray bats. Each summer, 300,000 of these flying creatures emerge from a single cave. The spectacle draws crowds, but there's more to the cave than the furry mammals. WBHM's Mary Scott Hodgen took a trip for this first story in our new series, Outdoor Connections.
The entrance to Sauda Cave sits right off Highway 72 in Scottsboro.
Oh, this is where we park.
That's it.
My husband and I drove up Labor Day weekend, hoping to catch one of the last bat shows of the summer. We arrived about half an hour before sunset, along with about a dozen other people. We all walk down a short path into the woods and arrive at a viewing platform that faces the cave. Valerie Hollingsworth traveled here with her family from Trussville.
I love to do anything that has to do with the outdoors and weird Alabama stuff that you can't find anywhere else.
Hollingsworth and her 10-year-old daughter, Ruby, take in the scene while waiting on the bats to emerge.
Oh, it's great. You can hear the tree frogs and the sun
like
going down.
Bat poop.
There's a little smell, but it's very that you can feel the air as soon as you get close to the cave. It's about 20 degrees cooler.
And the cave is really big.
They're right. It's cool and it's big. And that's why gray bats really like Sauda Cave. Anywhere from 200 to 500,000 bats spend their summers roosting inside, clinging to the walls and the ceiling. At night, they come out to feast on insects. As the fall temperatures arrive, the flying mammals migrate to another cave nearby, where they hibernate with even more bats. Nick Sharp is a wildlife biologist with the Alabama Wildlife and Freshwater Fisheries. He says these caves are vitally important for gray bat populations.
We have the largest gray bat summer cave on the planet, and then we have the largest gray bat hibernaculum on the planet. And so really, Alabama really is the heart of gray bat territory.
But the animals haven't always thrived, partly because their homes are also popular among humans.
Native Americans used caves way back in time for habitation sites, for ceremonial sites, for resource extraction sites.
Jan Schimmick is an archaeologist who studied caves across the Southeast. He says originally, Sauda was part of a Cherokee town called Saudi, and it's possible that there's Cherokee writing inside.
These caves were places where traditionalist Cherokees could also record and emphasize aspects of their culture that they believed in.
The Cherokees rented the cave to European Americans, who used it for a mining operation. This continued for decades after Native Americans were forced off the land. Miners extracted potassium nitrate from bat poop, which they used to make gunpowder. That's part of the reason locals like to explore Sauda.
Back then, you could just walk in, and Sauda was one of the neatest caves because it had all that niter mining operation going on in it.
Annette Bradford is a local historian.
And of course, in the 20s, they would have dances in there because it was cool year-round, right? So there was a nightclub there.
Annette and her husband, David, used to explore Sauda, crawling on their bellies as they went deep into the cave. They say all the human activity took a toll on the gray bat population.
Apparently the bats made it through everything.
They
were decimated when we saw them, literally decimated. Mm-hmm. But they've recovered.
Since the 1980s, Sauda Cave has been protected by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Nowadays, people are not allowed inside, but they can watch the bats emerge from a distance. Back at the viewing platform, cousins Mason and Jacob Hubble eagerly await the show.
So what do you think is going to happen?
The bats are going to come out.
A couple are going to come out, then they're going to fly back in, tell the others, and then another group.
Sure enough, shortly after sunset, the bats start filtering out. The boy's grandfather, Bill Hubble, looks up to the sky.
It's getting exciting because there's more activity. You see more of them coming out.
The bats form circles in the air, feasting on mosquitoes and moths. The show would have likely continued, but about 20 minutes after sunset, it started raining. The group disperses soon after, satisfied to have seen at least some of the bats. The animals themselves are now migrating to the winter cave, where they'll sleep among a million bats until next spring. Mary Scott Hodgin, WBHM.
Alabama Congressman Mo Brooks insists he's the only true conservative in the race for U.S. Senate. He's in a runoff for the Republican nomination for Senate on June 21st. On the campaign trail, he hits on issues such as gun rights and illegal immigration. But he's also faced criticism over what role he may have played related to the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. That's where we start this conversation between Brooks and WBHM's Andrew Yeager.
I want to ask about a speech that you gave at a pro-Trump rally the morning of January 6th. Now, much has been made about your comments of taking down names and kicking ass.
Do you know who I was referring to?
Who are you referring to?
Republicans.
Okay. But I actually want to ask about what you said next, and I'm quoting here. You said, "Our ancestors sacrificed their blood, their sweat, their tears, their fortunes, and sometimes their lives to give us, their descendants, an America that is the greatest nation in the world." And then you asked the crowd if they were willing to do the same thing. And you said, "Your answer is yes." And I just want to clarify, with the words of sacrificing blood and possibly their lives, were you calling for people to engage in some sort of conflict where people would be killed?
Absolutely not, although I understand that's the kind of thought that you try to put in listeners' minds. But there is a federal judge who was appointed by Barack Obama who has looked at all of the evidence and all of the law in the fake, frivolous Eric Swalwell lawsuit against me. And that federal judge, having looked at all of the evidence and all the law, entered an order dismissing me from that case because, as he said it, there was no plausible argument that could be advanced that my motivation or the effect of what I said had anything to do with what you just suggested. You ought to apologize on air for that.
So here's my question. By talking about asking the crowd if they were willing to do the same as the ancestors, which included sacrificing their lives, blood being spilt,
a federal judge,
what were you suggesting?
Appointed by Barack Obama, has already looked at that entire speech and looked at the context of the speech and looked at all the other evidence and dismissed outright Eric Swalwell's lawsuit against me.
And I'm not asking about Eric Swalwell's
argument.
I'm not asking about his lawsuit. I'm asking.
Well,
you're
suggesting that you're smarter than a federal judge who's looked at all the evidence.
I'm trying to
understand. And you shouldn't suggest that.
I'm trying to understand what you were saying.
Well, look at the federal judge's order and you will be able to discern it. Basically, I'm appealing to people's patriotism for them to understand and respect the sacrifices that Americans have made over the centuries in order to ensure that we have a republic, that we have the rights that are guaranteed in the Bill of Rights and the United States Constitution. I want everybody to understand the sacrifices that have been made before us. And if you look at the concluding request by me of the people who were in that audience, something you've, for whatever reason, chosen not to read, the only thing I asked anyone to do was to take the time to go to the United States Capitol and chant the words USA.
You know, on the campaign trail, you talk a lot about Second Amendment rights. You've been endorsed by the NRA. You know, we've recently seen shootings and mass shootings in Texas, in New York. There was even one here in Anniston, Alabama, not long ago. There are calls for increased background checks, red flag laws, raising the age to purchase assault-style weapons to 21. I'm imagining you're not in favor of any of those. But what can be done to prevent what seems to be very frequent mass shootings?
It's a very simple thing. Restore moral values. Restore respect for the life of others. Golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. One of the commandments, thou shalt not kill. Emphasize how precious life is.
You know, I'm thinking about other industrialized nations. They have much lower rates of mass shootings. If moral values are such a critical part of this, is that why we see fewer overseas?
Well, let's talk about why we have the Second Amendment right to bear arms. It's not for personal protection, although that's a benefit of it. It's not for hunting, although that's a benefit of it. It was put in the United States Constitution for one primary reason, and that was to ensure that the citizenry always had the ability to take back their government should it become dictatorial, should it morph into a kingdom by way of example, or some other dictatorial form of government. And fortunately, over the centuries, the Second Amendment has, to a very large degree, protected our republic from it becoming a dictatorship in which our rights are lost. Well, I'd love for these horrific shootings to stop, But the way to do it, in my judgment, is to restore moral values so that people understand how precious life is, and they're much less likely to engage in that kind of conduct.
So what I'm trying to get to is, if we see fewer shootings of these types in other countries, I'm thinking European countries.
Well, a lot of these other countries, they have over time, if you go back the last two centuries, they have been subjected to dictatorial rule. By way of example, all of Europe was conquered by Nazi Germany in the 1930s and 1940s. You know, one of the reasons, I don't know.
So my question, I'm trying to figure out, why does this happen here that it doesn't happen elsewhere? And if morals is such a...
Because we cherish the Second Amendment right to bear arms, and we are willing to do what is necessary to protect our republic, while other societies, to a large degree, apparently are more willing to subject themselves to the boot of dictatorial government.
Congressman Mo Brooks represents Alabama's 5th Congressional District. He's running for the Republican nomination for U.S. Senate. Congressman Brooks, thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
Live from Birmingham, I'm Miranda Fulmore with WBHM News. Katie Britt is officially the Republican nominee for the U.S. Senate race in Alabama. She won the nomination in yesterday's primary runoff election against North Alabama Congressman Mo Brooks. In a speech last night, Britt told supporters Alabama has spoken.
We want fresh blood. We want someone who will fight for our Christian conservative values, who will fight for the freedoms and liberty that this nation was founded on, and will fight for that American dream.
Meanwhile, Brooks blamed special interest for his loss.
The voters have spoken. They might not have spoken wisely. They may have been seduced by brazenly false advertising, but nonetheless, they have spoken, and I respect their will.
Britt will take on Democrat Will Boyd in November. Jefferson County Sheriff Mark Petway appeared before the county commission yesterday asking for $1.2 million to help with security during the World Games. Birmingham Watch reports Petway says the city of Birmingham reached out to the sheriff's office after other departments like the Alabama Law Enforcement Agency announced they were pulling out of providing security. Lieutenant Kerry Morgan says initially the sheriff's office was in charge of security at the Barber Motorsports Park and John Carroll Catholic High School, but now it's also in charge of security for the BJCC, Boutwell Auditorium, and the City Walk. The sheriff's office says the money would pay for overtime for deputies and supervisors working 12-hour shifts. The World Games is expected to bring hundreds of thousands of people to the area in about 2 weeks. The county commission asked for more information. You'll find more news anytime at WBHM.org. Today will be sunny with highs in the upper 90s, a slight chance of rain this afternoon. The Birmingham area will be under a heat advisory starting at noon today until about 6 p.m. tonight. Lows tonight will be in the mid-70s. It's 82 in Birmingham and 84 in Tuscaloosa.
In Vestavia Hills, authorities are still investigating what led to a shooting at St. Stephen's Episcopal Church. Last night, at around 6:20, police got a call reporting an active shooter at the church. When it was over, three people were killed and another injured. Joining me now is WBHM's Miranda Fulmore. Hi.
Hey, good afternoon.
What's the latest? What do we know?
Yeah, so we know a couple of things. After the shooting last night, a number of police departments responded to the call of the active shooter, including the Vestavia Hills, Mountain Brook, and Hoover Police Departments, as well as the Jefferson and Shelby County Sheriff's Office and the U.S. Marshals Service and the FBI. So it was a very collective effort. A lot of police departments responded. At the press conference this morning, Vestavia Hills Police Captain Shane Ware identified the suspected shooter as a 71-year-old white male who occasionally attended the church, but police haven't released a motive. They said he used a handgun, though.
Other news media outlets are reporting the possible name of the shooter. We have not independently
Correct.
Confirmed that, so we are not mentioning the shooter's name.
We're not. We're waiting on a word from the Jefferson County District Attorney's Office. They're expected to file charges this afternoon, but that's pretty much all we know right now is that it's a 71-year-old white male.
What do we know about the victims?
Yeah, so We know that there were three people that actually died. One of them on the scene, two of them at the hospital. The one that died on the scene was 84-year-old Walter Rainey from Irondale. 75-year-old Sarah Yeager from Pelham died at the hospital. And also an 84-year-old woman from Hoover died at the hospital as well, actually today, about 2 hours ago. Police say her family requested to keep her name private. So that's pretty much the extent that we know about the victims so far.
Other media outlets are quoting former Reverend Doug Carpenter, who founded the church in 1973, retired in 2005, saying there was a church member who hit the shooter with a chair and wrestled him to the ground. What have Vestavia Hills police said about this?
Yeah, so the police captain, Shane Ware, said just that, you know, another church attendee at that potluck gathering held the man down until police arrived. You know, let's listen to what he said after that.
It was extremely critical in saving lives. The person that subdued the suspect, in my opinion, is a hero.
Yeah, so like I mentioned before, Ware is waiting on releasing that individual's name, the suspected shooter's name, until we get confirmation of expected capital murder charges filed maybe this afternoon by the Jefferson County District Attorney's Office.
What has been the community reaction so far?
Yeah, so I know that there have been, there was a gathering today at another Episcopal church over in Mountain Brook. They were having prayer time, time to just kind of reflect on what had happened. Other people have gathered in the nearby Publix parking lot to talk about it as well. Different churches, there's been a lot of engagement on social media talking about what has happened.
Okay, WBHM's Miranda Fulmore, thank you. And you can continue to follow us on social media for the latest on this story.
Yes.
Civilian review boards are designed to investigate police misconduct and hold officers accountable when they step over the line. They've gained new attention since the killing of George Floyd by a Minnesota police officer. 1 year ago today, the city of Birmingham announced its own civilian review board. But as WBHM's Cody Short reports, it's not off the ground yet.
When Birmingham Mayor Randall Woodfin spoke about the board last year, he said it was part of reimagining public safety. Woodfin added the board would have representation from across the city.
This task force puts moms and dads, faith leaders and community activists, young professionals, and more at the same table as our police force.
Since then, there have been at least three people killed by the Birmingham Police Department. Eric Hall started to wonder, where's the civilian review board?
It made me question, after all of these police-involved killings, why has the civilian review board remained silent in regards to what's taking place with policing?
Hall is a community activist and is one of the co-leaders of the Black Lives Matter Birmingham chapter. He says he's tried to contact the board by calling the people who are either a part of it or who oversee it.
Community members do not know how to make grievances regarding police. It's not something that's spelled out clear.
There is a website for the Birmingham Civilian Review Board that gives information about how to file a complaint, but it can't take complaints online. It offers a form that can be mailed. A statement from the city says they assembled a board, held listening sessions, and researched practices in comparable cities. But more time is needed to adequately launch the program. Right now, the board is short one member. The statement says once the 5-seat panel is full, officials can move on to the public portion of the work. It says this will happen in the near future. Cody Short, WBHM.
When Coleman County was founded in 1873, it was advertised as a place with no blacks and no Indians. Its largest city was a sundown town. But one of the oldest communities in Coleman County was a safe haven for black people in the state, and in some ways, it still is. WBHM's Kyra Miles talked to residents of Colony about its rich history and present. Yeah.
On a hot summer day in August, hundreds of people gather in Colony, Alabama for an annual town reunion and homecoming.
Oh, hey, girl, how you doing?
Kids giggle their way through outdoor games and hamburgers sizzle on the grill. It's everything you want from a Southern cookout. They call the celebration Colony Day, and longtime resident Inez Malcolm looks forward to it.
We really enjoy our community, and a lot of people from different areas, they don't believe that black people live in Coleman County. And we do. You know, we coincide with everybody, and everybody gets along.
A lot of people here call the town the colony, and residents say to live here is to embrace the simple life. Kids play freely in the woods, and neighbors always share with one another.
Nobody in my community will ever go hungry, because there's always somebody that knows somebody.
On Colony Day, everyone honors their shared history. Colony was settled by formerly enslaved people in the mid-19th century on land that wasn't known for being very fertile. Since white settlers didn't want the land they lived on, the colony was largely left alone. And black farmers were able to work their land, make money, and eventually buy their plots. Robert Davis, who's a history professor at Wallace State Community College in Coleman County, says it was a place where you could be black without fear, especially in the early 1900s.
The black community in Coleman County owned more land than any other community. They had their own stores, their own mills, their own schools, the whole nine yards.
When Colony was established, it was not originally in Coleman County. They weren't welcome. Davis says there were no black people, or at least very few in the county. And the county's largest community, also called Coleman, was a sundown town. But at some point, Davis says mines opened on local coal deposits, bringing jobs and money for black laborers in the colony. And Coleman County leaders wanted in.
And you can't bring Stout Mountain and the coal mines in unless you also bring in the colony.
Combining the area's oldest black town and a known anti-black county could have been a recipe for disaster.
Coleman had a terrible reputation.
That's Earlene Johnson, one of Colony's oldest residents.
They said blacks were afraid to come through Coleman. Even on the train said they would pull the shades down when they rode through Coleman.
But Johnson says the relationship between the town and the county was more complicated than that. She says there were racial tensions between the colony and the rest of Coleman, but it wasn't as bad as in other parts of Alabama. Johnson went to college in Montgomery.
And I was in school doing the marches when Reverend King and all, and Rosa Parks were riding the bus, and I was in college by then. We did not have that kind of fight going on, you know, struggle going on, where they put dogs and what have you.
She says residents of the colony were largely self-sufficient, so they didn't need to go into Coleman often. But when they did, it was fine. After college, when she moved back to Colony, she became a teacher and later mayor. Johnson says she applied for any and every grant to get Colony a library and a town hall building. Her team's work to grow Colony led to the town's official incorporation in 1981. Johnson, who is now 84, says she hopes a new generation can continue to build up the colony. Back at Colony Day, Jasmine Cole is wearing a t-shirt that says Team Colony, Lifetime Member. She's 27, and she says she was inspired by Johnson when she was a young girl to continue building up the colony.
So I was more just following her footsteps, trying to get the colony back live again. Because it was like withering away.
Cole is the town's youngest council member, and she organized the last two Colony Day celebrations in hopes to keep people coming back.
I'm proud of this area. It's always been a good community, so it means a lot to me. It's my home.
Colony is not a town that is solely defined by its history. It's a community of people that supported one another through good and bad times. Cole says she wants to get more people to move to the colony and continue the town's self-made legacy. Kyra Miles, WBHM.
One way people can reduce their impact on the climate is to be more efficient with energy in their homes. But the technology to do that can cost a lot of money. One neighborhood in Birmingham is showing it is possible for those in a pinch. WBHM's Cody Short has more.
Last May, Bertina Robinson was driving on First Street South and discovered the homes that are part of Live on First, a new affordable housing development. Now she lives in one of the houses.
This is a smart system house. I can lock my doors from my phone. I can unlock my doors from my phone. I can turn my heat on from my phone. I can turn my air on from my phone.
Live on First is a group of three smart, highly energy efficient modular homes in the Titusville neighborhood of Birmingham. These homes are the first set of such homes built by Navigate Communities in the city. The organization, a subsidiary of the county's housing authority, is taking a modern approach to affordable housing. Nearly 25% of city residents live in poverty. Titusville sits on the outer edge of the downtown area. In the last year, there have been some new developments and reconstruction of older homes. As people continue to move into the core of Birmingham, some say that Titusville is next for redevelopment.
We address gentrification by making sure we target the people that we target. And that's not the folks that are making, you know, $80,000, $90,000, $100,000. Not that that's not anything wrong with that. But in this particular element of our work, it's those folks that are just, you know, $40,000 to $60,000 a year.
Navigate Communities CEO Lisa McCarroll says the smart homes are targeted at people who can't typically afford a home or spend all their money on starting costs and pay expensive utility bills. According to Alabama Power, smart homes are 35% more efficient than standard Alabama homes being built today.
Now, if I've spent all of my money to get into the home, now that I'm paying my utilities and living, $90, I can scrape up on $90. Scraping up on $300, that's a little bit harder to do.
Alabama Power is providing energy efficient upgrades and smart home equipment to the Live on First homes. The utility company is also involved with several other market rate smart communities across Alabama. Smart home resident Bertina Robinson, who works full time at Walmart, says her power bill has never been more than $80 a month. Plus, she can tell her home is energy efficient when she walks through the door.
Like, say I cut my heat off, when I come home, it's still warm inside my house. And also, my light bill is very low. So that tells me also that the home is energy efficient.
Jason Kirby leads the Sustainable Smart Cities Master's Program at UAB. He says while there may be a learning curve for the public to adopt modular smart homes, that kind of building is the way of the future.
Modular homes can be built in any size. It doesn't limit you to square footage.
Modular homes can sustain most weather conditions just like a traditionally built home. They use the same materials and must pass the same regulations. The biggest difference is that modular homes are built in a factory, which saves energy. They are then shipped in segments to the building site where they are assembled. A traditional home that's built on site requires a lot of waste removal and a longer build process. According to Navigate Communities, construction accounts for 61% of the home price, which is why modular homes are more affordable. Kirby says historically the construction industry hasn't been focused on sustainability or environmental impact. But with techniques like modular building, that's starting to change.
Trying to build smarter, using better materials, using more energy efficiency, and overall just trying to improve both the human aspects and environmental aspects of our job.
An established smart community in Hoover features induction stovetops and heat pump water heaters and relies on a microgrid of solar and battery storage for some of its power. Kirby says while Alabama doesn't have the highest solar potential because of its cloud cover, adding solar to a building project can further reduce its climate footprint.
We do get a lot of cloud cover. We have a lot of fugitive dust. It's not as efficient as it is in other parts of the world, but it does generate, after construction, essentially free power for us with no emissions.
With more of these smart homes, more people of various economic means can enjoy lower energy bills and reduce their emissions while living comfortably, demonstrating that energy-saving technologies like heat pumps, induction cooktops, and solar power are no longer just for the rich. Cody Short, WBHM.
In about 100 days, Birmingham hosts the World Games. It's an international competition for non-Olympic sports. Some are more well-known, such as flag football or bowling. Others you've probably never heard of. All this week, we'll be reporting on different aspects of the World Games, and today we start with one of those more obscure sports, korfball. It was created in the Netherlands, but as WBHM's Kyra Miles found out, the sport has some interesting ties to Birmingham.
If you've never heard of korfball, you might be asking,
is that a real sport?
It's a question Carl Jurger gets frequently. He's the president of the United States Korfball Federation.
There was a level of silliness because it does kind of sound like a goofy name. It's like, what the heck is this?
It's spelled K-O-R-F ball, and it means basket in Dutch. A school teacher in the Netherlands created the game, and it's kind of like a mix between basketball and lacrosse. Players pass the ball with their hands, but can't dribble. They score points by tossing the ball into a goal on an 11.5-foot-tall post that doesn't have a backboard. Oh, and the Netherlands dominates.
If you're going to be gambling on the World Games, bet on the Netherlands and korfball.
There's been a U.S. Korfball Federation since 1978, but Jurger says it's hard to recruit players.
One of the challenges we have in the United States about korfball is, how do you get people to play a sport that they've never heard of, that they can't really play against, where getting the equipment is hard?
That's why the USKF donated 10 korfball sets to Birmingham City Schools almost 5 years ago, as a way to get more kids interested in korfball.
Hey, let's go, let's go, let's go!
And it worked. The kids love it.
It's fun.
It's exciting. It's exciting.
At Glen Iris Elementary School, PE teacher Sharon Smith encourages kids to play korfball during recess.
You know, like we do soccer, we do a volleyball unit, we do tennis unit, and we've just added korfball to that unit as well.
Korfball was designed to be an accessible game for everyone. It's co-ed, but boys can't dominate the court. It's four men and four women on a team working together. And height isn't an advantage when you're shooting into an 11.5-foot goal. It's all about skill, agility, and teamwork. Smith says korfball is a household name in Birmingham City Schools, so much so that Coach Carol Roden at W.J. Christian School was going to be the coach of the U.S. korfball team homegrown right here in Birmingham.
Yes, I was fired up because it was an opportunity to represent the USA, quite honestly. And I love the fact when you have inclusion and everybody is included, one player can't dominate the game, and it forces them to play as a team. And I fell in love with the game.
Roden was ready to fly a team out to the Netherlands to train. But with so many new players, they just weren't able to qualify for the World Games. They would have had to be top eight in the world. But that doesn't stop the korfball greats from keeping hope alive that the U.S. will have a place in korfball championships again, like they did in the 1985 World Games in London.
For these World Games, six nations have entered, and we're going to start with the opening match. It's between the United States and the favorites and world champions, Holland.
Chris Frederick is a professor at Pace University in New York, and he's also a member of the bronze medal winning U.S. korfball team from the 1985 World Games, the first and only time the U.S. has ever medaled in korfball.
And I still get emotional about it because for a little kid originally from projects in New York City to growing up in the inner city in Pittsburgh, to have a chance to do this and to win a bronze medal was unbelievable.
Frederick was later chosen for the All-World All-Star team in 1987 at the International Korfball Federation World Championships in Holland. He's planning a reunion at this year's World Games for all his old teammates. He also hopes it inspires a new generation of American korfball players.
I mean, I hope that there's some renewed interest after the World Games Birmingham. And I'm sure that all of us old-timers would love to see korfball, you know, revived because it did so much for us and it was such an integral part of our lives.
Birmingham City Schools plans to continue teaching students korfball. The U.S. Korfball Federation will host demo games during the World Games for anyone who wants to give korfball a shot. Kyra Miles, WBHM.